The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Well, before we start into the Reader's Digest, this program is scheduled to broadcast on the 24th of December, which is Christmas Eve. So allow me and the folks here from the Reading Service to wish all of you a very Merry Christmas. And those of you who are not of the Christian faith, may you have a happy and joyous holiday season. Thank you so much for listening to us. And let's start off with the Dear Reader. Family Glue. I kept reading it, trying to figure it out, my mother said on the phone. Wasting my time. Come on, Mom, I say. Mother Goose is a stand-in for Dear Abby. Where's your sense of humor? Apparently not sharp enough for Reader's Digest, she quips. We're bantering about the October Reader's Digest as we do about every issue. It's as if we're tossing the magazine back and forth across the room, groaning and appreciating. Like she would with my dad if he were alive, except he's not, and she lives 3,000 miles away. She tells me she smiled throughout the bear who came to dinner. She didn't get the joke about a guy worried about running a 401k race. See, I explain, he's worried the race is 401 kilometers. Long pause. Still not funny. Then I hear her stop turning the pages. Footprints in the snow was so important, she says. We talked about that for a while. When I was a teenager, my mom worked at the local mental health department. The article concerned a man sitting on a mountain in shorts and tennis shoes during a fearsome storm, hoping to die. The woman who saved him was so strong-minded, she says, it's beyond belief that she could carry it off, getting him down. I read the last page over and over. It was so beautiful. We always loved the same stories. Mom is a keeper. High-energy, enthusiastic, blunt, a reader. She made me a reader. Now I send her a gift subscription simply so we keep having conversations like this. Nearly 20% of you either give or receive Reader's Digest as a gift. Let me know how sharing it with your loved one makes you feel. And thank you, as always, for reading. And you can write to him at letters@rd.com. And there's a picture of the gentleman, much younger apparently, with his mother, who's a very attractive lady, with gray hair and a smiling face. And let's look at letters. 20 Foods Proven to Heal. This article is right on time. We are dealing with our elderly parents and understand that we can avoid some of their ailments by changing how we are eating, exercising, and handling stress. The weight of the badge. The sobering and heartbreaking story brought me to tears. The men and women in law enforcement are the ones who arrive when called, stand between us and danger, and sometimes even take the bullet that was meant for us. To each one of them and their families, I say thank you and God bless you. Everyday Heroes. The story of Bev Wendelstedt's ordeal on Colorado's Grays Peak was a real heartwarmer. After six strangers took turns carrying her down the mountain after she injured her leg, Wendelstedt summed up the benefactor's generosity with these words, "I am still in awe." After reading this story, I must say I'm still in awe as well. What happens to great nicknames? My father's nickname is General. Most people don't even know his real name. It has nothing to do with the military. His father gave him a nickname when he was 4 years old because he was a general nuisance. That name stuck for life. He's approaching 90 now and still the general. We found a fix. I have what I think is a better fix than using a damp towel to reduce wrinkles if you don't have an iron. Keep a small spray bottle of water handy. Spray on the garment lightly and smooth it with your hands. I have to use my iron only 3 or 4 times a year. Footprints in the snow. Pam Bales did not set out to save a life, but she didn't give up when she found a stranger stranded on a snowy mountain trail, and both of their lives were in danger. I hope for more people to be like Pam, and I aspire to be like her as well. The Bear Who Came to Dinner. I remember reading this fascinating story when it was first published in December 1964 Reader's Digest. I told my fourth grade teacher about it, and she asked me to read the story to the class. The class loved it. Maybe some young student will be as enthralled about reading this reprint as I was reading the original. Dear Reader, a few years ago, my wife and I were coming home from a show in the Poconos. Suddenly, two cubs bounded out in front of the car. My wife had just enough time to comment how cute they were when their mother, who was not so cute, came along following. We live in the woods in northern Michigan. I had always been in awe of bears at the zoo. But that pales in comparison with looking up and seeing them rambling through your yard. I don't care how many bird feeders I have to replace. Age 10 gets a 10. The rule of age 10 really hit home for me. I loved fifth grade so much that I became a fifth grade teacher. Returning home to teach in the same classroom, thus I get to be age 10, for another 35 years. When I was 10, my father took a job in American Samoa. We traveled there on a new 707 Pan Am jet. I was enamored with the stewardesses, as they were called then. How helpful and nice they were. 20 years later, I headed to Honolulu for training to become a Pan Am stewardess. The best job ever. Every day he rose. A family tradition of chopping wood together warms the hearts of others. No one goes cold. Shane McDonald and his sons cut 80 truckloads of wood for those in need. And there's a picture of Mr. McDonald. He's wearing a sleeveless T-shirt with a Lowlife logo on the front and carrying a very large chainsaw. Good-looking young man. Washington is home to lots of trees. It is the Evergreen State, after all. And lots of fireplaces and wood-burning stoves, too. But what if you lived there and couldn't chop wood or couldn't afford to pay someone to do it? Luckily, Shane McDonald and his twin sons, Harrison and Henry McDaniel, 21, are happy to lend an axe. The three men chop truckloads of wood that donate to those in need. I want people who are burning cardboard because they've got nothing, Shane explained, to HeraldNet.com, or someone 75 with no money who has a broken shoulder and can't cut wood. The idea started as a father-son bonding project, he told MSN.com. I had to cut wood with my dad. He just loved doing it, says Shane, 48, a divorced father of six. He wanted to pass along that feeling, so he and the twins spent summer of 2018 like a clan of Paul Bunyans. The result was a great wall of wood piled up around their house in Lake Stevens, 35 miles outside of Seattle. Technically, it was 40 cords. A cord measures 4 feet high, 4 feet wide, and 8 feet deep. To buy that much wood cost about $10,000. It was too much for the McDonalds to use themselves, and when the weather turned cold that November, Shane started thinking of others. He posted on Facebook, if you are in need of firewood and cannot afford it, please PM, personal message me. If you know someone who burns wood and they're looking at a cold house this holiday season, please help us help them. Please help me and my boys make sure no one goes cold in our hood. The response was immediate. One man offered to donate a wood-burning furnace. Another raced over to Norm's, the mini-mart Shane owns, with more wood for the pile. One woman noticed the photo of the buff McDaniel man in the Facebook post, started to feel warm in other ways. Please post more pictures of you in a sleeveless shirts. I don't need the wood, but I truly appreciate the eye candy. Single mom, Caitlin Tyser, 29, and her 4-year-old daughter rely on wood-burning stove as their sole source of heat. So it was a relief to receive truckload of firewood from the McDaniels before the holidays. To cut that much wood brought me to tears, she told MSN.com. So much stress and anxiety is off my shoulders. I couldn't be more thankful. Not every recipient is effusive. Some aren't even friendly. It's just not in them, Shane says. They are mad at the world and mad that they had to ask for help. They just have no other option than freezing. But Shane is okay with that. Giving is the reward, he says. It has nothing to do with how well it's received. It's about how much it's needed. Trapped on the tracks. And there's a picture of a young lady with her son, and it looks like a fireman, a couple of firemen. I have to think every day of the rest of my life, Janice Esposito told Pete DePinto, second from left. It was late, about 10:15 p.m., when Janice Esposito arrived at the Bellport, New York train station, jumped into her Honda Odyssey, and began the 20-minute drive home to her husband and 7-year-old son. She just returned from visiting her mother and had traveled the route so many times she practically drove on autopilot. A left onto Station Road, then left onto Montauk Highway, and then, wham, out of nowhere on that awful night of October 10th, 17, a car T-boned Esposito's minivan, pulling her backwards some 100 feet onto the railroad tracks. She sat in a minivan, bruised, but mostly just stunned by the impact and by the vehicle's airbags. As it happens, Pete DePinto was getting ready for bed. He just closed his book and was crawling under the covers when he heard the high-pitched clang of metal on metal and a shattering glass coming from not far outside his bedroom window. A volunteer firefighter and retired teacher, DePinto, 64, never stopped to think. He grabbed a flashlight and, still clad in his PJs, ran out the door. Any firefighter would have done what I did, he told him, at my NBC5. We're always on duty. The first car he came upon 2,000 feet from his front yard was the one that had hit Esposito. Once DePinto concluded the driver was okay, he looked around and spotted Esposito's minivan, straddling the railroad tracks. And then he heard a gut-wrenching sound, the bell signaling an oncoming train. The gates were starting to come down, he told Newsday. I see headlights of the train. DePinto sprinted to the Esposito's minivan and banged on the driver's side window. She looked at him, her eyes unfocused. I don't know where I am, she said. She seemed unhurt. Honey, you're on the railroad tracks, DePinto shouted. We have got to get you off right now. He yanked on the handle, but the door smashed in and jammed shut. The heavy diesel train, traveling at 65 miles per hour, was hurtling toward them. DePinto ran to the passenger side and threw open the door. Please, God, don't let her be trapped, he thought. He pushed aside the deflating airbags, grabbed Esposito's arms, and pulled her toward him across the passenger seat until he could help her out and speedwalk her to safety behind a signal box a few feet away. Within 6 seconds, he estimates, the train plowed into her minivan. It was like a Hollywood movie, DePinto told reporters the next day. But this one had a twist. Last night, South Country Ambulance Chief Greg Mingingo told CBS New York, the hero in pajamas, not in a fire truck. Incoming! If a drone flying over your house might freak you out, then you understand how the green monkeys at Nicola Kaba National Park in Senegal must have felt. When researchers flew a drone 200 feet overhead to test how the animals react, their response was almost immediate. They made vocal sounds almost identical to the ones they make when an eagle, a monkey's nemesis, flies by. 13 Things. Speed up your holiday travel without getting a ticket. Driving. Do your research. In mid-November, Google releases an interactive report called Mapping Thanksgiving, based on Google Map data from the previous year. It breaks down the best and worst times to drive in 25 metro areas around the country. Number 2. Get a tune-up. The American Automobile Association estimates that it will provide roadside assistance to about 1.2 million motorists during the 2019 holiday season. To avoid a breakdown, get your fluids, battery, and tires checked out before you hit the road. Stick to two-digit interstates. Roads such as Interstate 80 are most often direct routes through cities, while three-digit interstates tend to circle around urban areas, according to the Federal Highway Commission. Number 4. Stay on course. The surest way to waste time on a road trip is to get lost. There are plenty of digital maps to help you out, but they aren't all created equal. According to Travel and Leisure, one guy was so determined to find the most accurate app that he spent a year studying three of the most popular, Waze, Apple Maps, and Google Maps. The best map? Apple. And stay out of traffic. That's where Waze, with its crowd-sorted update, rules the road. Another app, Flush, will get you to the nearest public restroom and tell you if it requires a key. Don't go too slow. Yes, the tortoise often beats the hare in the race. But in states where driving too slowly is illegal, the tortoise also can get pulled over. Most states now prohibit Sunday drivers from camping out in the left, a.k.a. the passing lane. In some states, a ticket for left lane lingering can cost up to $1,000. Flying. Number 7. Leave early. 6 and 7 a.m. flights are definitely the way to go if you have to travel during peak holiday season, says Janet Samova, a co-founder of Boutique Travel Advisors. Flights in that window are only about 8.6 minutes late on average, according to 538.com. 8. Get global entry. Traveling internationally? Global entry can speed up your return to the United States. The government-run program costs $100 for 5 years and includes TSA PreCheck, a summer domestic program that allows people who have been approved to get through security faster. Just bear in mind that you need to be interviewed and pass a background check, and it could take up to 100 days to process your application. Number 9. Download the Mobile Passport app. This app is government-approved and replaces the standard declaration form you fill out when you come back into the country and go through customs. Just input your passport information, snap a selfie, and provide your travel details and answer the usual questions about what you're bringing over the country with you. You'll receive an encrypted QR code that will then be reviewed by a customs officer and help speed you through airport lines. Number 10, skip the liquids. The TSA can make your life miserable over toiletries. A solution, says former New York Times travel writer Jada Yuan, is to leave yours at home and buy what you need when you arrive. Besides, even in small quantities, liquids are heavy. Your arms will thank you for ditching the extra weight. Number 11, ship your presents. This is a great way to avoid luggage headaches. The TSA recommends against, but doesn't forbid, bringing wrapped presents through the security. And if shipping helps you skip the dreaded baggage claim, so much the better. This is also a case where shopping for gifts online comes in handy. Have them addressed to you and tell your host not to open them, says Julie McCool of McCool Travel. Then borrow some wrapping paper when you get there. If you ship the gift yourself, Consumer Reports found that Postal Service was cheaper than FedEx and UPS for holiday packages. Order your food in advance, number 12. The smartphone app at your gate allows you to order food from airport restaurants that you can pick up or even have delivered to you before you board, says Harriet Backus, a travel writer and founder of snackattheairport.com. Check the airport's website in advance to see whether the service is available there. 13. Bonus tips. Choo-choo! Rail is a great way to go if it's a 2 or 3 hour trip, McCool says. It's probably going to save you time versus air travel. Amtrak lets you check cardboard boxes just to make sure they have handles and are ship-shape. Shower thoughts. The best ideas come in the shower. Reddit.com uses Share Some of Their Finest. As I continue to go bald, every day is both the worst day of my life and the best day I'll have for the rest of my life. Without Mr. T, I Pity the Fool would sound like something out of a Shakespeare play. Someone laughing after they are finished crying is the usual equivalent of a rainbow. Quotable quotes. You never go wrong when you take the high road. It's less crowded up there, Gail King. Choose your favorite spade and dig a small deep hole located deep in the forest or a desolate area of the desert or tundra. Bury your cell phone then and find a hobby, Nick Offerman, comedian. I really like being alive, Emma Stone, actor. When I'm on an airplane, not in a movie theater, I want to watch comedies. I think it's something to do with the altitude. I cry and I guffaw, and I have the best time. Quentin Tarantino, director. Don't wait your turn. Bet on yourself and have the confidence to stand up and say, my time is now. Robert F. Smith, businessman. Whenever it feels uncomfortable to tell the truth, that's often the most important time to tell of it. Jennifer Lopez, singer. If there is one door in the castle you have been told not to go through, you must. Otherwise, you'd just be arranging furniture in rooms you've already been in. Anne Lamott, writer. Now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. John Steinbeck, author. Point to ponder. Sometimes you are born into a family. Sometimes you need to go find it. Sometimes it finds you. But no matter how it comes together, when it does, family is what you fight for. Sandra Bullock, actor. Department of Wit, prediction season. The new year always brings prognostications, most of them wrong. You know who gets them right? A few good books and movies. And there's a picture of the movie Back to the Future with the young kid riding a floating skateboard, hoverboard. Sure, the DeLorean in the Back to the Future movie was cool time travel, but it had nothing on the levitating skateboard that Marty McFly, Michael Fox, hopped on to escape a bunch of thugs. 3 decades later, a 40-year-old French inventor proved the screenwriters prescient by hovering across the English Channel. Frankie Zapata strapped his boots to a board connected to a small turbine engine and made a 22-mile trip from France in 22 minutes. And unlike Marty, Zapata was smart enough to wear a helmet. Bluetooth. In his futuristic 1953 novel, Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury anticipated Bluetooth, describing wireless earphones that allowed for an electronic ocean of sound, music, and talk to be transmitted through the air. Imagine how thrilled he would have been with a Bluetooth toaster. That was the idea behind Griffin's connected toaster, which alerted you via smartphone when your toast was done. At $100, this baby cost a lot of bread, which may be why it was discontinued just 2 years after it was launched. Smartwatch. The Apple Watch lets you chat, play games, and watch videos on a device strapped to your wrist. Cool, huh? The Jetsons saw it, though, in 1962, when Steve Jobs was still in second grade. Wi-Fi. Nikola Tesla called it. In 1909, the famed electrical engineer told the New York Times, it was soon possible to transmit wireless messages all over the world, so simply the individual can carry and operate his own apparatus. No doubt he was thinking of the Karatase hair coach brush, which measured brushing speed and employed a microphone to listen to your hair, all to compute an overall hair quality score sent to your smartphone. Alas, it too is gone. GPS. Writer-author C. Clarke, 2001 Space Odyssey, sold to which and no one got lost. In 1956, he wrote that satellites could make possible a position-finding grid whereby anyone could locate himself by means of a couple of dials on an instrument about the size of a watch. Clark didn't mention his system might also track another person, such as a criminal. Last year, the New York City police nabbed a burglar who was wearing a GPS ankle monitor because he was still on probation for a prior conviction. Laugh lines. If my calculations are correct, Slinky plus escalator equals everlasting fun. My daughter loves all toys she sees in commercials, so of course I have to tell her that don't exist in real life, just on TV. You deserve whatever happens to you on a pogo stick. When I was a kid, I made all my toys watch Toy Story, so they knew I was on to them. This morning, I brushed my hair with an American Girl doll brush, because apparently she's the only one in my house who put things back where they belong. If the Lego movie is about anything other than parents cursing after stepping on Legos, it's not based on a true story. How to help a friend grieve. As a psychotherapist, Ishachi knew all the tools for dealing with loss. Then her own partner died. And there's a picture of a hammer and a card that says, Deepest Sympathy. Megan Devine. On a beautiful, ordinary summer day in 2009, I watched my partner drown. Matt was strong and healthy, just 3 months from his 40th birthday. We had joked that he was half mountain goat, able to scale waterfalls if need be. There was no reason he should have drowned. It was random, unexpected, and it tore my world apart. We had gone out to the river on the first sunny day after several weeks of rain. Matt went swimming while I stayed in the woods with our dog. When he called out for help, I saw him swept away by the floodless current. The dog and I ran in trying to save him, but were carried 2 miles downriver. Search team found Matt's body 3 hours later. I thought I knew quite a bit about grief. After all, I'd been a psychotherapist for nearly a decade. I had worked with hundreds of people, from those wrestling with substance addiction and patterns of homelessness to private practice clients facing decades-old abuse, trauma, and grief. After Matt died, I wanted to call every one of my clients and apologize for my ignorance. With all my experience and training, if anyone could be prepared to deal with that kind of loss, it should have been me. But none of what I learned mattered. And I wasn't alone. In the first years after Matt's death, I slowly discovered a community of grieving people. It wasn't just loss that we had in common. We shared stories of being encouraged to get over it, put the past behind us, and stop talking about those we had lost. We were admonished to move on and told we needed these deaths in order to learn what was important in life. Even those who tried to help end up hurting. Platitudes and advice, even when said with good intentions, came across as dismissive, reducing great pain to empty one-liners. At a time when we most needed love and support, each one of us felt alone, misunderstood, judged, and dismissed. It's not that people around us meant to be cruel. They just didn't know how to be truly helpful. Like many grieving people, we stopped talking about our pain to friends and family. It was easier to pretend everything was fine than to continue to defend and explain our grief to those who couldn't understand. Our culture sees grief as a malady, a terrifying, messy emotion that needs to be cleaned up and put behind us as soon as possible. As a result, we have outdated beliefs about how long grief should last and what it should look like. We see grief as something to overcome, something to fix, rather than something to tend or support. Even our clinicians are trained to see grief as a disorder rather than a natural response to deep loss. When the professionals don't know how to handle grief, the rest of us can hardly be expected to respond with skill and grace. There's another way. If we want to care for one another better, we have to rehumanize grief, and we'll have to talk about it. We have to understand it as a natural, normal process rather than something to be shunned, rushed, or misaligned. We have to start talking about the skills needed to face the reality of living a life changed entirely by loss. I've been the person howling on the floor, unable to eat or sleep or leave the house for more than a few minutes at a time. I've been on the other side of the clinician's couch, on the receiving end of outdated and wholly irrelevant talks of stages and the power of positive thinking. I learned firsthand why trying to talk someone out of their grief is both hurtful and entirely different from helping them live with their grief. Many people truly want to help a friend or family member who is experiencing a severe loss. Words often fail us at times like these, leaving us stammering for the right thing to say. Some people are afraid to say or do the wrong thing that they choose to do nothing at all. That's certainly an option, but it's often not a good one. There's no one perfect way to respond or to support someone you care about, but there are some good ground rules. First, remember that you play a supporting role, not a central role, in your friend's grief. You may believe you would do things differently if this loss had happened to you. I hope you don't get the chance to find out. This grief belongs to your friend. Follow their lead. You might also be tempted to make statements about the past or the future when your friend's present life holds so much pain. But you can't know what the future will be. It may or may not be better. Later, omniscient platitudes aren't helpful. Stick with the truth. This hurts. I love you. I'm here. Keep in mind that being with someone who is in pain isn't easy. Your friend cannot show up for their part of the relationship very well, and you will likely get hurt. Don't take it personally. And please don't take it out on them. In fact, one of the best things you can do for a grieving friend is to anticipate their needs. Don't say, "Call me if there's anything I can do," because your friend will not call. Identifying a need, figuring out who might fill that need, and then making a phone call to ask is light years behind your grieving friend's energy level, capacity, or interest. Instead, make concrete efforts. "I will stop by each morning on my way to work and take the dog for a quick walk." Then show up and do it. Of course, the real work of grieving is not something you can do for your friend, but you can lessen the burden of everyday life, assist in small, ordinary ways, such as refilling prescriptions, taking in the mail, or shoveling snow. These tasks are tangible evidence of love. You can also shield your friend by setting yourself up as a designated point person, the one who relays information to the outside world or organizes well-wishers. Your friendship is close enough. You could even offer to tackle projects together. There will likely be plenty of difficult tasks that need tending to. Things like choosing a casket, mortuary visits, sorting through and packing up a lifetime of belongings. Then be sure to follow through with your offers to help. Above all, show your love. Say something. Do something. Be willing to stand beside the gaping hole that has opened in your friend's life without flinching or turning away. Listen. Be there. Be love. Love is the only thing that lasts. And in a totally different mood, vote for the slowpoke. Based on a survey of yard signs in my neighborhood, it appears "Drive Like Your Kids Live Here" has a slight lead over both the Democratic and Republican candidates. And now, off to Consumer Reports. Should we break our bottled water habit? Difference in purity between bottled and tap water might not be as stark as you think. And yet Americans spent $31 billion last year on bottled water, in some cases because they believe bottled is safer. Our special investigation may rethink what you drink. For a glimpse into America's complicated relationship with drinking water, bottled and tap, consider the town of Hudson, Massachusetts, 40 miles west of Boston. This spring's residents grappled with fallout from routine tests that found chemicals in their tap water, known as pear and polythiothoracal substances, or PFAS, pronounced PFAS. These compounds have been linked to cancer, development delays in children, decreased fertility, and other health problems. In response, Hudson officials began distributing free cases of bottled water to residents and thought they had enough to last about 8 weeks, while the contamination was addressed. But demand was so great, with lines at times snaking out of the parking lot where water was distributed, that the supply was gone in less than a month. When residents arrived on a weekday in May at the donation site in town, they were greeted by an electronic sign that said, "Bottled water program has been suspended." Remarking on the situation, Thomas Moses, the town's chief administrator officer, says, "There's a lot of panic about the tap water, legitimately." After several months, the town's tap water was effectively treated by PFAS. But the clamoring among Hudson's residents for bottled water underscores a wider belief among consumers that bottled water is safer than what flows out of our taps. In some cases, as in Hudson, that's true. But a Consumer Reports investigation finds that information about bottled water quality is hard to find. Oversight of the industry is inconsistent, and as with tap water, some bottled water can be contaminated. For evidence, look no farther than Spring Hill Dairy Farm, a company 40 miles north of Hudson in Ward Hill, Massachusetts. Until recently, it provided water to several bottled water brands, including Whole Foods 365 Spring Water and Ice Canyon Spring Water, sold at CVS. But in August, as Hudson was resolving its own water crisis, Spring Hill shut down its bottled water business after tests found PFAS chemicals in its spring water. The bottled water Hudson provided residents was a different brand. Thank goodness. Fueled in part by concerns about the quality of the nation's tap water, not just in Hudson, but also in First Michigan, Flint, Michigan, and Newark, New Jersey, where lead contamination crises have generated national headlines, bottled water has become the country's number one beverage, with the average American consuming 42 gallons in 2018, and sales reached $31 billion in the same year. Bottled water's growing popularity stems in part from its convenience, but also from the perception that it's higher quality, H2O, 40% of Americans believe bottled is safer than tap, according to a nationally representative 2019 Consumer Reports survey of 4,225 U.S. adults. That's a perception encouraged by the bottled water industry, even as it relies on municipal supplies. Nearly 64% of bottled water sold in the U.S. is filtered tap water, according to a 2018 report from the advocacy group Fruit and Water Watch. One example, earlier this year, Cott, which sells several brands of water, told investors, "We intend to capture new customers as we capitalize on favorable consumer trends, including concerns about deteriorating municipal water quality." But even as bottled water sales have risen, tap water quality overall doesn't appear to be getting worse. Since 2013, the percentage of U.S. population served by community water systems with at least one reportable health-based quality violation has stayed below 10%, according to the most recent data from the Environmental Protection Agency, which regulates tap water. These systems provide water to more than 90% of Americans, according to the EPA. The United States provides some of the safest drinking water in the world, an agency spokesperson says. To be sure, the vast majority of bottled water sold today also appears to be safe, but it isn't necessarily better overall than tap, and there are some reasons for concern, CR found. In response, Jill Calora, Vice President of Communications for the International Bottled Water Association, a trade group, says many Americans think both bottle and tap and decide what type of water is best for them based on taste, convenience, and quality. Over the past year, CIHAR has interviewed more than 50 experts and state and federal regulators and amassed thousands of pages of regulatory filings, lawsuits, and consumer complaints, and government documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act request. CIHAR's investigation shows that safety inspections of water bottling facilities by the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates bottled water, have declined over the past 15 years. An FDA spokesman says that the agency takes prompt action when it obtains evidence that a product poses a safety risk, adding that the federal regulations show that bottled water is safe, wholesome, and truthfully labeled. But while the FDA requires companies to test quality of their products, the agency typically doesn't conduct its own tests, and companies aren't required to make results of the tests available to the public, and often don't. CR was able to get reports from just 133 bottled water brands, barely half of those we identified. Moreover, when tests are performed by independent organizations, problems can emerge. For example, CR's spot test of three bottled water products in April 2019 helped to prompt one brand, Parafiel, owned by Keurig Dr. Pepper, to take its unflavored mineral spring water off the market after high levels of arsenic, a potentially dangerous heavy metal, was uncovered. And IBWA says the industry is subject to rigorous oversight. When bottled water companies strive to make safe, high-quality products, there have been instances when products did not meet FDA standards, it says. When that has happened, bottled water companies have taken the appropriate steps to ensure the safety of consumers. Steyer also found that decision of what to use as your primary drinking water depends on where you live, the health of your municipal supply, and the pipes in your home. And the long-term solution isn't more Americans to turn to bottled water, but it is to fix the nation's water infrastructure, advocates say. The EPA says that over the next 20 years, fixing and maintaining the nation's reservoirs, treatment plants, and pipes will cost an estimated $24 billion annually, $7 billion less than what Americans spent on bottled water last year. Bottled water is not an acceptable substitute, says Mary Grant, director of the Public Water for All campaign at the Food and Water Watch. We need to build resilient water systems. The fate of public water. The vast majority of Americans appear to accept access to safe tap water, but some communities face real problems, In Huzzit, for example, town administrator Thomas Moses spelled out a quandary communities such as his face. While the EPA currently offers voluntary guidelines on PFAS chemicals, two comments one should stay below 70 parts per billion, there's currently no mandatory limits. Without federal standards, states and municipalities are left to decide on their own whether to look for the chemicals and what to do if they find them. Huzzit, for example, began testing for PFA chemicals in 2016 and discovering alarming PFA levels this year. It's easier for public water suppliers to address contaminants that have established limits, Moses says, but emerging threats such as PFAs will always come along. In the next year, the next 2 years, the next decade, it will be something else, he says. The concern among Huzzit's residents about the town's water supply reflects a common view across the U.S. In some places, water infrastructure appears to be at a breaking point, with some lawmakers seeking an additional $35 billion per year to maintain it. The lack of investments is widespread. Detroit Public Schools shut off all drinking water last year because of a high copper and lead levels. A town in West Virginia has been on a boil water advisor since 2002 because the system is in a state of disrepair. And some Americans live without running water at all. As of 2018, nearly 340,000 homes in the U.S. didn't have access to running water, according to a CR analysis of federal census records. What's more, 34% of Americans, or 110 million people, say they regularly avoid drinking tap water at home because of safety concerns. According to CR's recent surveys, about one-sixth say they don't drink their home tap water at all. Part of the issue could be lack of information. Under EPA regulations, people on community water systems should receive an annual copy of their consumer confidence report, which spells out the quality of their tap supply. But more than 5,000 such systems were recently cited for violating that rule. And EPA data shows about 80% of people with municipal water say they were never received a CCR, and 60% have never heard of it, CR survey found. Pushing back on plastic. Just 20 miles from Huzzit, the town of Concord, population 17,000, has had a different experience with bottled water. Several years ago, it became the first community in the U.S. to ban the sale of single-use plastic bottles of water. In making their case, supporters emphasized the environment toll of the billions of bottles Americans dispose of each year, as well as the town's long history of safe tap water. Still, it took supporters more than 3 years to persuade Concord's residents to support the ban. We're up against 30 years of marketing by an industry with endless resources, says Jill Apple, a concerned resident with hated the effort. As concerned about the environmental harm from plastic water bottles spread, the industry is responding in part by starting to package water in, for example, cardboard cartons. Indeed, you can now buy water in such containers in Concord. The war against tap water. Even a quarter of a century ago, buying water in any kind of bottle would have seemed ludicrous, says James Saltzman, environmental law professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of the book, Drinking Water, A History. Barry S. N. Amos, 2012. Eventually, bottled water came to be seen as chic, Saltzman says, in part because of celebrity endorsements. The trend continues. In the past year, Dwayne Johnson and Gwyneth Paltrow, among others, have partnered with bottled water brands. But it wasn't until the 1990s, when Nestle introduced the convenience of the single-use PET bottle, that bottled water caught on with the public, according to Bottled and Sold, Island Press, 2010, a book by Peter Gleick, co-founder of the Pacific Institute, an environmental group. Over the following decade, the growth of bottled water was also spurred by industry efforts to play up the purity of its product. In 1999, consumers browsing the IBWA's website may have seen this question: does bottled water contain any harmful chemicals that could pose a threat to human health? The IBWA's answer was no. But federal records show that in the 1990s, there were around 50 recalls of bottled water for excessive chlorine, mold, and fecal coliforms. The IBWA still defends its statement, saying that was meant to be a general in nature, and that many of the recalls posed no meaningful health risk. Yet independent tests at the time had found contamination. A 1999 study by the National Resource Defense Council of more than 100 brands found that nearly 1 in 4 violated California limits for arsenic or other carcinogenic compounds. And tests CR conducted in 2000 found samples at or above the arsenic limit of 10 points per billion, a standard that was finalized in 2005. The industry's adversarial stance towards tap water intensified from there. Text document of Gleick's book. At the time, Gleick tells CR, there was really explicit campaign to demonize tap water. He quotes Robert Morrison, who was then soon to be chairman of Pepsi's North American Beverage and Food Division, as saying in 2000, the biggest enemy is tap water. It just has its place. We think it's good for irrigation and cooking. The next year, Coca-Cola, which sells Dasani, generated controversy when it was revealed that the company worked with the Olive Garden restaurants on a campaign called H2NO to push money-making beverages instead of tap. Normally, Coca-Cola uses public water as its primary source for Dasani. Bottlers continued to take shots at tap water. As of 2006, Fiji ad, Glick also covered in his book. The label says Fiji because it's not bottled in Cleveland. Cleveland officials later testified the city's public water as well as the bottle of Fiji and found that Fiji water contained arsenic while its water did not. Fiji reportedly said it was only a joke. The industry has since tried to dial back the anti-tap rhetoric, framing bottled water as a healthy alternative to sugary drinks. But even now, records show that bottlers view the deterioration of the public's water infrastructure as the content of their business prospects. Such, some as Coca-Cola and Pepsi have said in public filings, that tap water quality problems could hurt their bottom line by jeopardizing the safety of primary ingredients for their businesses. Others see a tap problem as a potential boon. Early this year, Primo Water, which produces purified bottled water that can be filled at self-service dispensers, wrote in a filing with the Securities Exchange Commission, we believe the market for purified water continues to grow, evolving taste perceived health benefits and concerns regarding the quality of municipal tap water. Maria Mullen, Primo's Vice President of Consumer Experience, says that many consumers choose bottled water as an alternative to sugary drinks, and that the company isn't choosing to make municipalities the bad guys. Rather, it's reacting to the market. You have to have your head in the sand that you don't see there are growing issues related to the quality of municipal tap water, Mullen says. Back in Hudson, Town Administrator Moses says that even with the test results showing that Hudson tap water is safe, some residents just can't be persuaded to drink it. The water we're producing meets all the current regulations and health advisory. I mean, that's all you can say. The H2O information gap. Government regulators generally don't test bottled water themselves. And until, bottled water makers aren't required to publish their own retests. So over the years, the past several months, CR assembled a repository of test reports from bottled water brands ourselves. Ultimately, we identified 236 such brands, but were able to get reports from only 133 of them, or 56%. Either from their website or by contacting the manufacturer directly. Information on the safety of tap water is also limited. For example, the EPA doesn't regulate private wells, which supply water to 14% of Americans, according to CR surveys. And for some contaminants, notably lead, the EPA testing provides only a representative sample of each system's quality, not what comes out of each home's tap. Just over 7% of the community water waste system just over 7% of the community water systems regulated by the EPA had at least one instance of violating a health-based standard, recent EPA data shows. That includes exceeding a drinking water contamination limit. When it comes to bottled water, precise figures can be even harder to come by. But the reality is that contamination in bottled water does exist. It's just difficult for consumers to find out about it. CR's review of water quality test reports we gathered from companies and regulatory agencies, combined with our spot test of bottled water, found that 6% of brands had a contaminant that exceeded state or federal limits. CR also reached out to all 50 states on their bottled water requirements, and 32 provided responses. Of those, only 14 say they require bottlers to notify regulators immediately about test results showing excessive contaminants. When instances of contamination are documented, regulators can be slow to respond. The lax enforcement contributed to scenarios such as Keurig Dr. Pepper's two-month delay earlier this year importing pentothal from the market, even after the company temporarily suspended production following CR's test showing arsenic at almost twice the legal limit. The information about these kinds of problems is not always widely shared. For example, Starkey Water, owned by Whole Foods, withdrew its bottled water twice in 2016 and 2017 because of high arsenic levels, but neither instance showed up in CR's review of archives of the company and FDA press releases. CR tests last spring found that Starkey still has about 9 parts per billion of arsenic, just shy of the federal limit of 10 parts per billion. Starkey said earlier that it tests every production run of water before it is sold and would never sell products that do not meet FDA requirements. New Jersey regulators have also found bottled water with antimony, a potentially harmful heavy metal at 5 times the federal limit, arsenic at double the limit, and radium, a radioactive metal, but none of these results appear to have been widely publicized. Massachusetts published a link on its website about the recent contamination of Spring Hill bottled water with PFAS, but did not otherwise appear to alert consumers. Emerging contaminants such as PFAS pose particular reporting problems as regulators try to play catch-up. Michigan, which has been grappling with PFAS in tap water in some communities, implored the IBWA last fall to require its members to start testing for the chemicals. The state's representative said in a letter obtained through FOI request that it had conversations with unnamed bottlers and that the PFAS contamination didn't appear to be a problem. But the letter added, that statement is only true of these specific bottlers. IBWA says it now requires members to test for PFAS, but it doesn't represent all bottlers. Spring Hill, for one, is not a member. By comparison, oversight of tap water is more standardized and rigorous, says Gleick at the Pacific Institute. For example, when a community water system discovers a level of contaminant that potentially poses an immediate health threat, it must notify regulators within 24 hours. That's one reason tap water contamination is an all-too-common feature of the evening news broadcast. There's plenty of attention already in the media to the times we have problems with our tap water systems, Gleick says. I think the bottled water companies understand they don't have to do that. The future of drinking water. Going forward, two things seem certain. The bottled water market will continue to grow, and bottled water is not a long-term solution to the nation's drinking water problems. If we don't invest in our water infrastructure, we're going to have more people with tap water they cannot drink, says Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. Her group supports the Water Affordability, Transparency, Equity, and Reliability Water Act of 2019, now in Congress. This act would increase funding by $35 billion per year for drinking water and wastewater improvements. Another key step, community water systems need to ensure that the people they serve get easy-to-understand annual water quality reports. In CR survey, a quarter of people on municipal water who tried to learn about the quality of their local water said they couldn't find the information. The organizers of Concord Ban on Single-Use Water Bottles say that the municipalities with safe drinking water can and should make it a point to ensure that their residents know about it. Communities with safe water supplies should consider making it easier for people on the go to refill their own water bottles. That's what Concord did. At the day, the town has a robust network of businesses in town providing free tap water to anyone who comes in and asks for it. Hudson experience suggests that addressing problems with tap water works too. The town invested in a new filtration system capable of removing PFAS, and testing last August didn't detect any PFAS in the town's water. For homes, a number of filters that remove toxic substances don't improve them, they remove them, such as lead are available. Pricier options such as reverse osmosis systems can be installed, and professional water testing can be performed for as little as $20. State or local health departments might also offer free water test kits. If you want to drink bottled water or have to rely on it for any reason, contact the bottler for a copy of its most recent quality report. The results are from the company itself, but provide some reassurance. IBWA's advice, don't buy products from any company that won't share its water quality report. Can plastic water bottles make us sick? Some research suggests that the plastic used for bottled water could pose some risks, though the evidence isn't conclusive. One concern is microscopic pieces of plastic, which may leach into chemicals into water. A 2019 study found that people who drank only bottled water consumed an average of an additional 90,000 microplastics annually, compared with 4,000 who drank only tap water. Chemicals and microplastics could potentially contribute to reproductive problems, obesity, and other issues. There are also concerns about antimony toxide, which is a possible carcinogen that could be released into the water if plastic bottles are exposed to hot temperatures long enough. One study revealed antimony levels just above federal limits after 5 days of exposure at 160 degrees Fahrenheit, a temperature that cars parked in the sun could in some circumstances reach after a few hours. The International Bottled Water Association, a trade group, says there's no known health risk from water with occasional small breaches of antimony limits. But if you regularly drink bottled water, you should store it carefully or fill your own non-plastic water bottles with tap water. Where does the water in your bottle come from? The answers may surprise you. With growing concerns about affordable, safe water, they may raise some thorny questions about who controls and makes a profit from the water we drink. Municipal water, Aquafina and Dasani. Dasani, owned by Coca-Cola, and Aquafina, Pepsi, primarily use tap water from public water supplies, which also is the source of nearly 64% of the bottled water sold in the U.S. Both obtain water from several cities. They treat the water, then treat the water. It appears to be a highly lucrative business model. For example, based on documents obtained through the public records request, we estimated in 2018 Coca-Cola and Pepsi combined paid Detroit at least $1.4 million for 198 million gallons of water. Coca-Cola confirmed to CR that the company returns about half the water as waste. Pepsi did not respond to questions about its wastewater. At an industry average of $1.07 to $2.49 per gallon, that would make water worth a potential $110 million to $256 million, or as much as $21 million per month. Spring water, Poland Spring and Zephyr Hills National Spring Waters. The waters in these Nestle brands come from springs in the U.S., 8 in Maine for Poland Spring and 5 in Florida for Zephyr Hills Natural Spring Water. But at least for Poland Spring, Nestle doesn't gather this water from the mouth of a running spring. Rather, it bores into underground supplies that feed the springs. That's central to an ongoing lawsuit alleging that Poland Spring isn't spring water. Nestle denies the claims. The company also generated controversy in Florida over plans to obtain more than a million gallons of water per day, in part for its Zephyr Hills Natural Spring Water, from an aquifer that feeds a popular recreation spot. In response, Nestle has said its springs are sustainably managed, but critics says it benefits a big business while depleting the spring's supply of water. And artesian wells, artesian water, Fiji water. Artesian water comes from a confirmed aquifer, an underground source that, unlike spring water, can be reached only through a well. The water is bottled and filtered at the source, in Fiji, on an island nation in the South Pacific. A chief criticism, the environmental and economic cost of not only harvesting the water, but also shipping it several thousand miles across the ocean. Water is Fiji's biggest export. Why carbonated water often gets even less oversight. Consumers can't get enough water, especially aerated versions, such as seltzer and sparkling water. Demand for plant water's bubbly counterparts is rising. Just in 2018, sales of $1.98 billion, that's up 39% from a year prior, compared with a 6% increase for regular bottled water. But in the eyes of the Food and Drug Administration, most artificially carbonated water, think bubbly and polar, isn't bottled water. Instead, FDA teaches as a soft drink. That's crucial. As soft drink, these beverages are exempt from the federal quality standards that apply to bottled water. The reduced oversight means companies usually don't have to adhere to the same federal contamination limits. The exceptions, naturally carbonated waters and artificial ones with labels that include certain terms, such as mineral, artisan, and spring, that the FDA says are now covered by federal bottled water standards. For example, Perrier carbonated mineral water is regulated as a bottled water, but LaCroix sparkling water is not. Making matters more confusing, there are lots of kinds of carbonated waters, and the term are sometimes used differently depending on the company. To sort out what's what, CR provides this general guide. Carbonated sparkling water. Catch-all terms that usually refer to unsweetened or unflavored water that had carbon dioxide injected during production. Seltzer. This often refers to artificial carbonated water without anything added other than sometimes flavors. Club soda, and artificially carbonated water, typically with baking soda, potassium salts, or both to provide a tang that goes well with many alcoholic drinks. Tonic water. Another classic mixer, tonic is made with carbonated water and quinine, as well as sugar or artificial sweeteners, such as aspartame. Note that the FDA limits how much quinine can be added. How to test your tap water. How safe is your tap water? Finding out can take some time, effort, and money, but it's worth doing. Most people on municipal water who pay their own bill should receive an annual water quality report called CCR, or Consumer Confidence Report. If you don't receive yours, call your local water supplier, and if you rent, contact your landlord. Systems with 100,000 or more people must also post reports online. You can find it on Environmental Protection Agency website at epa.gov/CCR. In the report, look for a summary that shows whether any contaminants were found above government cutoffs, and if so, what the potential health risks are, what is being done to fix the problem, and what you should do in the meantime. For questions, call your local supplier or the EPA Safe Drinking Water Hotline at 800-426-4791. If you're on well water, you won't get a CCR, so you should get your water tested. That's also a good idea if your home was built before lead-free pipes were mandated in 1986. Even if your CCR says that your municipality water is free of lead, it can leach into your water from the pipes in or leading to your house. Many kits are available to do-it-yourself tap testing, but it's not always clear what they test for or how accurate they are. The EPA recommends a certified lab. Find one at epa.gov/DWLabCert. Testing typically costs $20 to $150. Your community might provide test kits free of charge. Once you know what's in your water, choose a filter that suits your needs. For municipal or high levels of contaminants, reverse osmosis filters are often best. They can remove lead, arsenic, bacteria, and other contaminants, but they take up a lot of space. For improving taste or odor, dealing with less serious contamination, a carbon filter can help, but it might not remove all lead. Regardless of which filter you choose, make sure it's certified to NSF national standards by an independent lab, such as the CSA Group, Underwater Laboratories, or Water Quality Association. A pitcher filter is good for drinking water. A filter that attaches to your sink is a good choice for that, as well as for water used to cook and wash dishes. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and have a most joyous happy holidays. Thanks so much for listening.